25 years ago, Australian publishing legend Hilary McPhee released her memoir, Other People's Words, The Life and Times of an Accidental Publisher. It tells Hilary's story and the story of McPhee Gribble, the independent publishing company founded in Melbourne in 1975 that brought future classics like Puberty Blues and legend-to-be authors like Tim Winton and Helen Gardner to bookshelves around the country and the world. Now in 2026, Hilary McPhee's published her Other People's Words all over again, with a new chapter called 25 Years On, which traverses all manner of subjects from emojis to AI, even to Radio National, which Hilary says is packed with podcasts and often excellent interviews, many of which, she hints, could have another life. Hopefully this will be one of them. Hilary McPhee, welcome to Sunday Extra.
Thanks, Julian.
Now, you describe the chance of putting out a new edition of Other People's Words as an astonishing gift. How did it come about, Hilary?
Well, look, the publishers, Melbourne University Press, who have published me from time to time. When Louise Adler was there, she approached me quite often to write things, and I usually did because Louise's approach to everything was something that dovetailed often with mine. But MUP is a very different place now, and when they approached me recently to just simply write an extra afterword to the book, I was astonished that there would still be interest in it. But when I read it, I think I could see why, because it's very much looking at the kind of history of publishing in this country in a way, and our little attempt at all that back a long time ago, beginning with the Whitlam era, did achieve it quite a bit, and quite a lot of the books are still in print, which gives me so much pleasure.
Hilary, now that you're a republished author, I wonder if you could speak a little bit about republishing of books and reviving older works from the perspective of a book publisher.
Well, you have to try and put yourself in the shoes of who your readers are going to be, and that's obviously difficult because I'm a very old person now.
One of the things that struck me in particular reading the book now is how many resonances there are with the issues of today. In particular, for example, you write about your involvement with the publication Mianjin, and it obviously has had a slightly torrid time lately, though it's recently been revived in a new home. Could you tell us about your engagement with Mianjin and your take on what's become of it lately?
Well, my engagement with Mianjin was 1,000 years ago when I was a university student, when you weren't allowed to, I was doing honours, and you weren't allowed to work in those days. So I sort of sneaked into a job at Mianjin because they desperately needed someone to do, you know, really primitive, basic filling in cards kind of work. And I secretly had a little job at Mianjin, paid for very intermittently by Clem Christensen. But being in there, I learnt a hell of a lot because he had real writers coming in. They weren't just, you know, myths that came up the stairs and had arguments and drank red wine, and all kinds of people came into Mianjin in those days. But this was way back, and I didn't stay at Mianjin very long. I was there for a couple of years, really, but I learnt a lot. And I went on after that and published a few issues of a very pretentious magazine called Theatre. And then I went off, as everybody did, to London and worked in the British Council, where you were kind of aware of publishing too. But when I came back to Australia, I couldn't do what I wanted to do, which was archaeology, because it had all moved to Canberra. But I then got a job at Penguin, and that was the beginning of it all, really, at Penguin Books, which were out at Ringwood. And it was just before they did that investigation into Portnoy's complaint and managed to free up the censorship laws. You know, they were gutsy at Penguin, very gutsy, and I was very lucky to be there at the time. And then I met Di Gribble, and on we went and started Repeat Rules.
Yes, and the rest indeed is Australian publishing history, born of the really strong desire that you and the wonderful Di Gribble had just to work together. You had a great chat with David Marr on Late Night Live last year about the McPhee Gribble story, and I highly recommend that to listeners. But I wonder if you could give us a mini version of that now, how McPhee Gribble came about, and in particular the role of a certain kids' book series in indirectly bankrolling a generation of Australian literature.
The idea for kids' books came from John Hooker at Penguin, who came to us saying, that he thought he could get these books through the English company. He never took Australian books from Penguin. They'd taken Ivan Sutherland, one or two rather literary people, but never young practical books. And we thought, because we had young kids, we knew everything about young practical books, and we thought we could write them. So we started, and we wrote, I think, 18 or 20 of things called Practical Poppins, which were all tested in the office, a little office that we had then, and tried out on kids. We were absolutely scrupulous about making sure everything worked. So there were therefore no warnings in Practical Poppins. That was the rationale behind them. We didn't believe in telling kids to be safe, to look after themselves, to not blast their parents if they could do things. And they sold like hotcakes, those little books. They were published first in Australia, but then they went to England and the Poms liked them very much and decided they'd take more and they would distribute them into America and into Europe. And we sold all kinds of translations. And they really bankrolled other McGregor's series publishing. You know, books by real authors like Alan Garner and later Tim Winton and Barry Hill and Kaz Cook, all kinds of amazing people. And they went on selling. I still get some PLR for Practical Poppins. I'm astonished when I see what it is, and it's wonderful. It's just little bits of money that comes in every year. And so I'm still rather proud of them and wish someone would reissue them. I so want someone to come and say, "Will we issue Practical Poppins?" And I would say, "Go for your love. Do them all over again." And that you have to make sure you're publishing for kids who make up their own minds about things, not treat it as a, you know, with great caution and trepidation as children's. Children's playgrounds indeed are like that. You know, they're very safe and they have to have a parent standing by to make sure the child coming down the slope doesn't fall into a puddle, that kind of stuff. You know, it's a very cautious world out there for kids and I wish it wasn't.
On Sunday Extra, we're speaking with Hilary McPhee, whose memoir, Other People's Words, The Life and Times of an Accidental Publisher, is out again in 2026. Although, as we've heard, we are still looking for a republisher of the Practical Puffins series, which would indeed be a great thing. In the new afterword, Hilary, you say that conversation was always the starting point of editing. I wonder if you could speak to that a little. And I wondered if there's a particular McPhee Gribble book that you look back on as being the result of a particularly fruitful engagement between author and editor?
Oh, God, no, that's an impossible question, Julian, because I really regard everybody that we publish as kind of old friends in a way. I mean, that's what happened. And you take great pride in the way their books keep on selling. They keep on going in Penguins and other things. I love the way Kaz Cook has, you know, picked up the whole idea of the modern girl's guide to everything and run with it. She's done amazing books out of that idea. You know, there are, writers have a huge lives in the world and publishers are just facilitators, basically. But it all does begin with conversation, in my experience. If you can't, I suppose you can publish people you never see, but if you don't get to talk to them and know what they're trying to do, I think the books are lesser because of that. We spent a great deal of time talking to writers, having them in the office if we could, or on the phone if we couldn't have them in the office. You know, Tim Winton was one of our authors right from the start pretty well. We weren't the very first publisher for Tim. He had Alan Unwin number one, but then they said they weren't going to publish stories, and Tim's next book was a collection of stories, so he came to us. And I think they've been kicking themselves ever since.
Yeah, that doesn't look great as a decision in retrospect.
It's a really dopey decision. I can't imagine why they made it. Because stories, people read stories, they love stories. You just have to persuade them that the book is exciting. So Tim was somebody that we, you know, didn't see a lot of because he lived in Western Australia. But when he came to Melbourne, he was always in the office. And we had the kind of office that people liked to come to, and they'd sit there all day, some of them, watching what went on. So it's impossible for me to pick favourites. They're all my favourites. there's a really limp answer for you.
Well, well said, though. Now, you also talk about AI in the new afterword. As a user, you seem quite impressed by it.
Claude AI is quite funny. That chatbot is quite a funny chatbot.
But you also say that much of the hack work in book publishing can be done by AI, and many dull jobs have long gone or will go any day now. There is a lot of anxiety about AI. So I wonder if you could give us the Hillary McPhee take on the pros and cons of AI for the book industry and beyond.
Well, that's a kind of impossible question too, Julian. Really, I'd like to turn this back on the chaser. I think chatter and publishing have got an awful lot in common. You know, I really do. I think the comic imagination and the imagination that enables people to write fiction have a great deal in common. And I think they're not in danger, but we've got to find ways to keep them alive. And I don't think AI is the way.
Certainly, it's proving very powerful in being able to reproduce some forms of writing. But I think the point that you make is that genuine imagination and real authorial risk-taking is something that you don't see and you don't think will come through AI. Is that right?
No, I don't think it can come. I think AI likes saying it's all about our ideas amplified, that ridiculous statement. I think imagination is the crucial thing, which is what we're talking about, I think.
Mm.
And it's a comic imagination. It's an imagination that gets inside politics. It's an imagination that enables us to envisage a whole new way of writing. I mean, that is very exciting. I think there's an awful lot of great things going to come out of this, but they're not going to come out of just chatbots. They're incredibly tedious things to deal with, a chatbot. My God, chatbots are so limited and will remain limited because they're not about anything that's going to do other than hoover up other people's important work, which is what's happened with reviewing and so on. I was very interested to go to that amazing artist at the gallery, Yoko Kusama, the Japanese artist of 96, who lives in a posh psychiatric care place in Tokyo. Watching the public respond to her extraordinary work, which I've got mixed feelings about, as you always have about amazing work, but it was watching the public responding to it. They were having a sensation that they would not have normally. And that's what artistic work is all about. And I think that's what writing good stuff is all about too. It's really about people coming to work in different ways and responding in their own ways and talking about it.
Hillary, I wonder if you could speak a little bit about the importance of risk-taking for book publishers and where and to what extent you see that happening in the contemporary Australian market.
I think it probably is not happening to anything like the extent it used to happen, where you could get away with doing something a bit risky until somebody noticed you did and then they'd try and sue you. But there's much more legality in the whole publishing exercise, as there must be in broadcasting now, where people are cautious, they're timid, they're anxious not to rock the boat too much because they're scared the boat might turn back and bite them, as indeed it can do. But that's why the ABC has got to be brave and is getting braver again, I think. And I hope you'll tell me about it when we finish talking about this.
Perhaps once we're off air, you sound a bit more optimistic than me, Hillary.
I'm optimistic. Yes, I have to be optimistic. Yes, and the national broadcaster is obviously the only thing I listen to. So, you know, my kids would tell me I don't know what I'm talking about, but the national broadcaster is absolutely where things can happen in a very big, all-consuming way still, and it's very important.
Hillary McPhee, it has been a delight speaking with you. Thank you so much for joining us on Sunday Extra.
Thanks, Julian. Great.
Hillary McPhee's Other People's Words, The Life and Times of an Accidental Publisher, now with added afterword, is back out in 2026 and available in all good bookstores, I'm sure.
Find more great ABC RN stories that take you beyond the headlines on the ABC Listen app.